from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum this morning, the mass extinction that killed off the dinosaurs was known to have coincided with the Earth getting hit by an asteroid. Next time, we may be the asteroid, according to Elizabeth Colbert's new book, The Sixth Extinction and Unnatural History. Colbert writes that humans are not only witnessing one of the rarest events in life's history, we're also causing it. Elizabeth Colbert joins us for the hour coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. By most scientific lights, there have been five mass extinctions on the Earth over the last half billion years, the most recent 66 million years ago when an asteroid collided with the Earth. With a number of species on Earth presently vanishing at an unnatural rate due to a range of different human-made factors, we are, according to Elizabeth Colbert, on the brink perhaps of a sixth mass extinction. This is the title, actually, Mass Extinction, of the New Yorker staff writer's newest book, which has been widely compared in its impact by a number of different sources to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. She's also the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, which we talked about with her here on Forum. And she joins us here in the studio this morning for our second hour. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Well, let me give listeners some statistics here that are right from your work. A third of all reef-building corals, a third of all freshwater mollusks, a third of all sharks and rays, a quarter of all mammals, and a fifth of all reptiles and a sixth of all birds are all headed toward oblivion or extinction. I don't know where the good news is in that, but, you know, it's some might say, well, elevated extinction doesn't necessarily mean mass extinction or full extinction. I'm sure you've heard that argument. You say what?
Well, that's true. I mean, we are clearly at a time of very high extinction rates. You know, whether we rise to the level of the five major mass extinctions of the last half billion years, you know, certainly remains to be determined. There have also been somewhat oxymoronically minor mass extinctions in the record. And you know where we're gonna where this extinction event is gonna fit into that is obviously impossible to know when you're in the midst of it. But you know, increasingly you hear scientists comparing us to the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs and many other groups. I should say the dinosaurs always get top billing, but
so I got to jump in.
Yeah,
there.
Go ahead.
Because there are those
yeah.
who say no, it wasn't necessarily the asteroid. It's not incontrovertible. I know you write about the Alvarezes, father and son, and how they seem to make it incontrovertible. But is it really that the asteroid was?
Well, we're just at the 30 year. We just passed the 30 year mark of their landmark paper on that subject, and on the occasion of that. There was a piece, a journal article in Science written by many, many prominent scientists saying, yes, the evidence is in. You know, this is obviously a murder mystery that's 65 million years old. So the trail is pretty cold, let's put it that way. But based on all of the available evidence, the pretty broad consensus is that, yes, it was an asteroid impact. There are certainly people who will still argue that. There are people who will argue anything in the scientific world,
honest. Religious arguments about the dinosaurs.
Yes,
but there are
yes.
also arguments, I remember, about evolution and birds and dinosaurs and all that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, many, many issues will be debated in science for quite a long time. But I think, you know, As much as things can be settled when we're talking about evidence that's 66 million years old, I think this one is heading towards settlement. How's that?
Well, also heading towards settlement are all these many factors that you key in on and write so, may I say, fluidly and trenchantly about. And we're talking about climate change, of course, which you've done a lot of work on before this book, carbon emissions being absorbed in the ocean, all that changing chemistry of the ocean, and frankly, many other things. I mean, the rainforests. But the thing that really, I suppose, people don't know that much about are the invasive species. And that's big.
Yeah. Invasive species actually are implicated in, some people would say, the majority of extinctions that we know about. Invasive species turn out to be really important. And one of the points that I make in the book, is, you know, it's not my point, it's really a point that biologists make, is that what we're doing is effectively about 250 million years ago, all of the continents of the world were smushed together in this supercontinent that's been called Pangaea. And then they drifted apart due to plate tectonics, and we have eventually got the world as we know it, right, with seven continents. But what we're doing by bringing together all of the flora and fauna of the world just by transporting things around the world effectively in a biological sense is erasing those boundaries between the continents and smushing them back together. So a term has been coined, the new Pangaea. We're creating the new Pangaea. We're bringing everything back together. And that can have, it turns out, very devastating consequences. Often it has no consequences, right? You move something around the world, it can't make it in a new place, so it just disappears, or it establishes itself and it doesn't do any damage. It just sort of coexists with what was there before. But a certain percentage of the time, and even if it's a very small percentage, but you're doing it over and over again, it obviously adds up. A certain percentage of the time, you bring together these evolutionary lineages that have been separated for tens of millions of years, and very devastating things happen.
Well, let's talk about some of those devastating things. Brown tree snakes, for example, came from Papua New Guinea in the 1940s. They were put into Guam and probably on a military ship, I guess, from what we've been able to deduce. They just ate things up, literally ate things up. I mean, native birds, native mammals, all of the bats except maybe one. And then you've also got the example of this Central African wolf snail, which was introduced in Hawaii about a decade after that in the 1950s. And again, it's killed off about 90% of the native snail species. I mean, these are the kinds of things that we really are dealing with.
Yeah, the snail story is a really interesting one because the snails of Hawaii, people are not, you know, they're like Darwin's finches. They're not as famous. They weren't as... Well, Darwin's finches are actually not very colorful either, but these snails were I guess, not very charismatic. But it's a case where, you know, a very small number of snails reached the Hawaiian Islands, and they radiated out into different niches, different islands to inhabit different habitats. There were something like 700 species of snails on the Hawaiian archipelago. And then what happened was there was an invasive snail that got to Hawaii, and it was an agricultural pest. And so people said, well, we want to get rid of this snail. We're going to bring in this giant African snail that's going to eat that snail. But lo and behold, the giant African snail did not want to eat the agricultural pest snail. It only really was fond of the native snails. And so, as you mentioned, something like between 75 and 90% of the Hawaiian Islands' original species of snails are now gone or very, very, you know, headed towards oblivion.
Despite the good intentions. I mean, it makes me think of T.J. Boyle's novel. I mean, it really is right out of that scenario.
Absolutely. And there are many examples of this where something is brought in to control something else. So, for example, in Australia, I'm sure people have heard about the cane toad, which is this, you know, enormous fat toad. It was brought in to eat beetles that were eating sugar. Instead, it's just devastated native fauna. It's poisonous, the African cane toad. And so things try to eat it. Other, you know, like mammals will try to eat it and they will drop dead. It's had a devastating effect. So our record in terms of, you know, it's sort of like I know an old woman, you know, who swallowed a fly and then she swallowed whatever. I can't remember the lyrics to the song. Then she swallowed something else.
I don't know why.
And then she swallowed something else, though. And so we can compound the problem of one introduction with another introduction. And nowadays, actually, this has happened often enough and been devastating enough that scientists are very, very reluctant to introduce a species purposefully without massive, massive testing to see what's going to happen.
How do all these fungal diseases get into the arteries and veins of human history? I mean, they threaten really every species here in America and every amphibian species on the planet. And I think you said that one of the most gruesome things you saw was up in Vermont in a fungus cave inside of a cave.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story that actually unfolded, you know, literally as I was writing this book. And that is a story of a fungus. It's since been traced back to Europe. It came over quite possibly on someone's shoe or, you know, in their suitcase. It almost certainly landed somewhere in upstate New York because that's where we first started to see these huge die-offs. It's very devastating to bats. It gets on their skin. It irritates their skin. You can see it. It's white nose syndrome. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of it. It's called white nose syndrome. It looks like the bats have been dunked in talcum powder or cocaine, some people have said. And what happens is that bats in the northeastern U.S. hibernate during the winter. So they hang by their toes, their body temperature drops, their immune system shuts down, and they really, really need to conserve energy. They're very small little creatures. They need that energy to get through the winter. There's nothing to eat. And this fungus irritates them. They wake up. They fly around. There's nothing to eat. They drop dead. And that cave that you were alluding to, I went there right after this fungus reached Vermont. It was a cave that used to have hundreds of thousands of hibernating bats, and hundreds of thousands of them had dropped from the ceiling of the cave onto the ground, were decomposing. It was really a horrific, horrific sight. And that is a case of something that was introduced totally unconsciously. We have no idea who did it. They have no idea who they were, that has come from one continent to another and had terrible effects.
Talking with Elizabeth Colbert, New Yorker Magazine staff writer and author of a new book called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. She'll be appearing, actually, speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. You can meet the author there this evening. Let's talk, though, about all the CO2 going into the atmosphere, because when you talk about the other extinctions about 250 million years ago, there was another one that involved CO2 from a volcanic event, which is a little bit eerie. I mean, this one, if it's going to happen, is our fault. This one is clearly made by humans. But the ocean density changes are really what we're talking about to some degree, maybe perhaps even more than the atmospheric changes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if you look at, you know, if you talk to scientists, certainly if you talk to marine scientists, one thing that really, really worries them that has not gotten, I guess, the press it deserves, let's put it that way, is this issue, as you say, of ocean acidification, it's called. And that's the phenomenon where when you pour CO2 into the air, as we are, you know, there's just no debate about that. We're pouring about 10 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere every year, you know, just by burning fossil fuels. A lot of it ends up in the ocean just because we're, you know, the oceans cover a lot of the planet. They cover, you know, 70% of the surface of the planet. And wherever you have an interface between water and air, you just get an exchange of gases. So you pour CO2 into the air, a lot of it's going to end up in the oceans. And that's what's happening. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms a weak acid. It forms carbonic acid. So people drink it, in Diet Pepsi, for example, but it's still an acid. And it's changing the chemistry of the oceans very radically. And as you allude to, the worst mass extinction in the history of the planet happened about 250 million years ago at the end of what's known as the Permian period. And it's believed that it was caused by this major sort of burst of volcanic activity that emitted a lot of CO2 into the air and warmed the planet very radically and changed the chemistry of the oceans very radically. And very soberingly, scientists have recently tried to, you know, figure out, okay, at what rate was CO2 being emitted at that point? And the best estimate that they can come up with, this is a pretty recent paper, suggests that we are pouring CO2 into the air faster than was poured into the air in the events leading up to the end Permian extinction. So you increasingly hear, I have heard very serious scientists say, you know, we cannot rule out that kind of an outcome, the end Permian, which was the worst mass extinction in history. I find that, even I, who wrote this book and feel like, you know, I couldn't be surprised by much anymore, find that, you know, just extremely sobering and terrifying, really, I guess.
There's a lot that's alarming in this book. I mean, there's no getting around it. It's grim, and yet we knew about extinction theories before we even knew about evolutionary theories. That's the irony sort of a lot of people don't recognize. And let's talk a little bit about Georges Cuvier, the guy who gave us pterodactyl and was actually a French anatomist, way ahead of his time. He understood extinction theory.
Yeah, he was a really interesting guy. He's one of these people whom history has sort of shortchanged. I guess I'm going to speak on his behalf. And he to understand his contribution here.
Excuse me, people don't like to believe catastrophism. They just don't like to accept it.
No,
still to this
no.
day, they're hearing you and probably you.
Exactly. We're gonna hear from them. But to appreciate his contribution, and I should also add that he made contributions in many different fields. He was a very, very gifted scientist. You have to go back before him and realize that people just didn't believe in extinction, even though they were increasingly, as Europeans went to the New World, uncovering these really weird bones that they had really hard time explaining. So, for example, mastodons, American mastodon bones, had been shipped to Europe. People had a really hard time explaining them. They thought, well, maybe these bones belong to elephants. Maybe they belong to hippos. You got all sorts of interesting and wrong theories.
Including Thomas Jefferson's.
Thomas Jefferson. At one point, this animal was called an incognitum, right? Just an unknown. And Thomas Jefferson was one of those people. He loved fossils. He loved natural history. But he was one of those people who firmly believed that nothing had gone extinct. Nothing could go extinct. And when he sent Lewis and Clark to the Northwest, he expected them to find mastodons or incognitums roaming around. He was firmly convinced of that. And then Cuvier came along and said pretty simply, if they were out there, we would have seen them. So it was not a brilliant act of, you know, scientific research. It was just sort of a commonsensical conclusion. And he was right. He posited a whole lost world, in fact, and he found many, many. He had people send him their fossils from all over Europe. As you say, he named the pterodactyl. That's where we get that. He named the mastodon. There are many names that we get from Cuvier. And eventually he came to realize that there had been many lost worlds, as it were, that there were different fauna at different times. And he was the first person, for example, to realize that there had been sort of this age of reptiles that preceded the age of mammals.
With all the species gone, and you do write about, the golden frog and the great auk, which was hunted down, and animals like the mastodon simply no longer a part of this planet, you get into almost what amounts to a kind of prognosticating when you say that by half a century, by the end of the century, half the species will be gone. I mean, that's pretty much the scientific take on it.
Well, I think people would say, they would issue a couple caveats to that, and I hope those caveats come through in the book. First of all, one thing is predicated on, you know, those estimates are based sort of on continuing to do what we're doing. So continuing, for example,
that's a positive estimate. You read James Lovelock and others.
Yes, to say even less, right. And I think they would say committed to extinction. So if we continue, for example, to pour CO2 into the air and into the water at current rates, people have tried to model what will happen to the climate, what will happen to the oceans. And they would say, you know, sort of best estimates are that, you know, somewhere on the order, we're talking orders of magnitude here, will be committed to extinction by the end of the century. So there will be marching off towards extinction, and it will be, you know, virtually impossible to get them back. How's that?
That's sensible. But a lot of people think the coral reefs are our canary in the coal mine. I mean, that's a whole ecosystem.
Yes, and the prognosis for coral reefs is really, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's really grim, and that is
that, how can you sugarcoat it?
Yeah, it's impossible to sugarcoat. There are definite, you know, many marine scientists believe that coral reefs will be the first, you know, major ecosystem to be just done in by human impact. So there will still be corals, you know, but they will no longer be able to form these fantastic reefs that support a tremendous variety of species. Anywhere between 500,000 and something like 9 million species spend part of their lives on coral reefs. And any of your listeners who have ever been to an intact reef, which is harder and harder to find, I should say, will know that just when you look down into a reef ecosystem and you see this amazing profusion of life that you just never see on land, really. It's just extraordinary. It's an extraordinary experience.
And that's, again, acidification of the ocean to a great degree, but also fishermen dynamiting. You know?
Well, there are a lot of things that are affecting reefs right now. For example, changing water temperatures are really dramatically affecting reefs. Reefs have this interesting symbiosis going on. They have algae inside them, basically, that feed them, that provide carbohydrates for them, and they get a lot of their energy from. And when water temperatures get too high, this relationship breaks down, they expel them, and they basically starve to death. So coral bleaching, those bleaching events people have heard about, which are happening more and more frequently because of water temperature. Water temperatures are going up. Those are already really reducing coral cover in a lot of parts of the world. So, for example, in the Great Barrier Reef, which is the world's largest reef, coral cover has declined by something like 50% just in the last few decades.
Elizabeth Culbert is our guest. She's staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Believe it or not, started out as a political reporter with The New York Times and then shifted into science. Says something about her gray matter and versatility. And we want to invite you to join us. But before I do that, let me ask you about population and how that figures into this whole equation. If you would have listened to Paul Ehrlich, we would have been extinct years ago. But the fact of the matter is we're pretty much using up our resources. And the Earth can't – there's a kind of carrying capacity here that can't sustain the population.
Well, I think that that's one of the big questions. And I guess one of the questions that – is implicit in the book is, you know, is it possible that we, you know, are so clever, humans are really, really clever and very, very adaptable, that we can, you know, go on for quite a long time, even as other species drop out, but that maybe we're using the resources that otherwise other species would have used. So, you know, is it ourselves that are in danger, or is it really everything that we share the planet with? This is a question that, you know, is really hard to answer.
Well, there are some who think the answer is going to be technology, new paradigm. You know, that's going to save us because we have resilience, because we're so inventive.
Yes, and I think that is certainly possible. The question, I suppose, comes with any new technology. You know, does it also have impacts on other creatures that we, you know, are not necessarily able even to anticipate, right? So a lot of these things, you know, when people started to burn fossil fuels, they didn't anticipate that they were changing the climate and changing the chemistry of the oceans. And the next technology that comes along may be very beneficial for humans. And I guess a question I would ask is it going to be beneficial, you know, for everything else?
Well, we can't learn a lot from past extinctions because some of them go so far back, as you've indicated. But the pattern of survival, I think you've said, has to do with just how many groups are involved in, so to speak, or a lot of species are more apt to survive, I think we can conclude, you've suggested.
Well, when people have gone back and, you know, people are actually very interested, actively interested in this question, precisely because we seem to be in another mass extinction event. What comes through? What does tend to come through these extinction events? And they've found very, very few rules. You know, it's very hard to say that there's a rule here. The dinosaurs, you know, were the dominant group on Earth for tens of millions of years. And they all, every species of non-avian dinosaur died out. Why is that? No one really knows.
Our guest again, Elizabeth Culbert, her new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. She's also author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe. And you are invited to join us if you have questions or comments. We welcome your participation in the program. Join the conversation by dialing our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls and the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. A number of ways to communicate your thoughts and to join the conversation. You can also go to our Facebook page, but please feel free to join us. Again, Elizabeth Culbert will be speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m., and we'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour, New Yorker staff writer Elizabeth Culbert, whose book is called The Sixth Extinction. And again, she'll be speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. We're going to go right to your phone calls. And let's begin with TJ. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. In past mass extinctions, what has followed has been evolutionary radiation or adaptive radiation, where new species have evolved to fill niches left open by extinction. Can't we look forward to that? I don't think my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Elizabeth Culbert.
If you look forward enough, I suppose you could say you could look forward. But, you know, usually when we look forward to something, it's like next month or next year, not 10 million years from now. So I think you know, after, for example, the extinction that did in the dinosaurs, I think scientists would say it took several million years for that process to take place and for you to get, you know, ecosystems that were anywhere near as diverse as they were before the extinction event. So eventually, I guess, you know, in the long run, the really long run, you're right. But in any terms that are at all meaningful to humanity, I'm afraid we can't look forward to that.
We'll look forward to another caller. Jack, that's you. Good morning.
Wondering if there's any information about the starfish die-off, and then secondly, if you could also speak to Monsanto's insistence on killing all the milkweed, which is affecting the monarch butterflies. Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
The starfish die-off is really interesting. I don't have any information that I can offer on that. It's so far, I believe, pretty mysterious what's going on. It's this syndrome of starfish sort of wasting away. So we will await what people find out about that. I'm afraid I can't offer anything more on that. The Monsanto and the milkweed is a really, you know, generally tragic situation, which is that monarch butterflies rely on milkweed, and you know, a lot of crops now are engineered to withstand herbicides that kill milkweed. So our whole Midwestern United States is, I don't want to say it's milkweed free, but there's a lot less than there used to be. And monarch butterflies seems to be one of the things that's really devastating them. And they were down to just record low numbers this summer. And I will say from personal experience, I have always, every summer, gone out and collected a monarch butterfly caterpillar from my backyard, from the milkweed in my backyard, and raised it and watched the amazing process of it becoming, you know, a chrysalis and then a butterfly and letting it go. And it's always been a great experience for me and for my kids. And this summer, I could not find a single one.
Well, we did a whole show on this. It's in our archives. And let me get another caller on. And Ed, that's you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Mike. See, I'd like to bring the attention of your guest and yourself about Fermi paradox. Have you heard of that? That was named after Enrico Fermi. Have you ever heard of it?
No. Go ahead. Tell us.
Yeah. What Fermi was talking about E.T. with some of his friends at luncheon one time, and he said, where are they? His implication, you know, we don't have much technical civilization, you know, outside Earth, because most technical civilizations destroy themselves in the process. And look what we have done just in about 100 years, and Earth is about to go between global warming, carbon dioxide, which is dissolving the reefs. A lot of species are vanishing, 60%, some of them are 80%. So Fermi was a very wise man. Yeah, people should read more about it. It's called the Fermi paradox. So, you know, that's what we have. Not to mention if we get a gamma ray burst, which can just end us all in a fraction of a second.
Well, thank you for the Enrico Fermi enlightenment there. Good to hear from you. We're going to hear from another listener in Berkeley. Bob, hi, you're on.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to comment. In the beginning of your introduction, you referred to this impending extinction as being, quote, unnatural. And
well, the subtitle is An Unnatural History, the subtitle of the book. Yeah.
Right. So I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, humans are just agents of the natural world, and we may just be the ultimate invasive species. So it's all just kind of part of how things work. And I just wanted to make one comment. When I was a student studying microbial ecology, one of my professors said that the appearance of green plants was a major environmental disaster because at the time, all the bacteria that lived in the world were anaerobes, and oxygen is very poisonous to them. So that was an example of, you know, we think of green plants as wonderful, as we should, but from a microbial perspective, this was a poisonous disaster. Those are just my comments. Thank you for a great show.
Yeah, and thank you for the comments. Actually, you're right about the anaerobes. They disappeared along with the dinosaurs. Yeah.
Well, I think what your caller was referring to actually was sort of the invention, if we can use that word, of photosynthesis, which was, you know, a couple billion years ago, and it's called the oxygen revolution. And he's absolutely right that a lot of, you know, anaerobes had ruled the earth, and they were reduced to being, you know, what we now fondly refer to as things like pond scum. They're still around, but they don't rule the earth
many of them
anymore.
Informed
some of my best friends, right? So that was, now that predates you know, anything that we would call you know, these big five mass extinctions, because at that time there was no animal life. We're just really talking about the period of time here, when since complex animals evolved about 500 million years ago.
Dovetailing on that last call, here's a listener who writes, this assumes that humans are above nature. I'm one that believes that we are a part of nature and what we do is perfectly natural on the evolutionary scale. The Great Lakes come to mind as an example. As industry rose, the heavy metal content of wastewater rose and drained into the Great Lakes. The fish populations dropped dramatically and then rebounded. As the rebound occurred, new environmental standards were imposed for wastewater and the heavy metals had to be removed. As a result, the heavy metal concentration dropped in the lakes and the fish populations again dropped dramatically. The point is, as long as a species is not fully eradicated, it's selecting for physical and behavioral traits. Slow adaptation is better than abrupt changes, as exampled in the lakes.
Well, I mean, this whole question of are we natural and are we or are we unnatural? I don't claim to have the ultimate answer for that. I mean, I think one of the
I do. It's unnatural to destroy the planet. How's that?
Okay. I mean, is an asteroid natural? If you want to define the great, geological forces as natural, then we're up there with those now, and we're also natural. And if you want to say that destroying the planet's unnatural, then we're unnatural. And I guess my point is only that we're very, very unusual. Natural or unnatural, we're extremely, extremely unusual in the history of life on this planet.
Here's Mark, who emails, by virtue of her years of reporting, Elizabeth Colbert is nothing short of heroic. She has gone to the literal ends of the earth to report on ocean acidification, Arctic ice loss, and now large-scale species extinction. As a result, she probably knows more about the varied facets of our climate change crisis and its far-ranging repercussions than almost anyone else alive. Given that, what is the single largest climate change issue that she would wish to bring to our attention, the thing that keeps her up at night, as it were? Using her most dispassionate reporter's eye, does she see any significant area of optimism?
Well, I want to thank your listener, whoever that was, for that very flattering intro. I think that what I guess I would say keeps me up at night in terms of climate change is, this question of whether you're going to reach, whether there are certain thresholds in the climate change at which point you get very dramatic changes very, very quickly. So, where the system absolutely runs in a way that we can't really cope with at all. And that's certainly possible. We just don't know where those points are in the system or if they are in the system. So what we don't know is to a certain extent even more frightening than what we do know, which is very, very frightening. And the end of it is, do I see any reasons for optimism, right? I wrote a book on climate change about 7 or 8 years ago, and on some level, unfortunately, it's not out of date, which is pretty sad because it should be out of date because something dramatic should have happened since then on our political front. Unfortunately, it hasn't. I do see increasing awareness. I was pretty heartened, in fact, to hear John Kerry was in Indonesia recently talking about climate change. Barack Obama was in California talking about climate change. So maybe, just maybe, we're on the threshold of getting at least a semi-rational political conversation on the issue going, which
well,
I have
Obama
to say.
Just pushed this truck statute through which
efficiency standards, new efficiency standards. Yes.
Well, another online comment: is it only when the last tree has fallen, the last bluefin tuna or shark fin is eaten, the temporary blip of secondary predators is depleted, the land has been depleted of its nutrients and erosion kicks in, that our government and religious institutions will ask, who is next? As Jared Diamond documents in Collapse, all this has happened on a smaller scale in the past to many other civilizations. Unless we change how we act, we'll be the last ones to go, but we shall, and it will not be pretty. I don't know. We'll be the last one? I think maybe the cockroaches. Let me get another caller out here. And Wolfgang, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, I remember driving around the back roads of Sonoma County in my 20s. I'm 61 now and just, feeling really bad for all the toads and frogs that were everywhere all over the roads. And of course, I haven't seen one of those. I haven't seen this in years. So if you could comment a little bit on our amphibian friends, and then I'll take all this off the air. And also, what kind of blowback are you getting while you promote your book with people who don't believe in these kinds of things? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the questions.
Well, the amphibian crisis is really what I begin the book with, and it's a real phenomenon. Amphibians have the very dubious distinction of right now being the world's most endangered class of organisms. There are several species in California that are very, very highly endangered right now. And scientists I spoke to, Californians, for example, talked of, you know, going up into the Sierras where they used to find so many frogs and toads that you couldn't, as their caller said, you practically couldn't avoid stepping on them in the high mountain meadows. And now you go up there and you see virtually none. So that is a very real thing, and it seems to have been caused in large part or in significant part by a fungus. This is one of these species, not unlike the bat die-off that I was talking about before in the Northeast, where we moved, humans moved some kind of fungus around the world, and that fungus is devastating bats all around the world. And in terms of blowback, I want to say happily, perhaps I've just been in California, but I haven't gotten too much blowback.
You're going down south?
Yeah, I'm not. I haven't been invited to a lot of states. Let's put it that way. But so far, I haven't. Maybe that will start soon.
Here's Robert, who writes, I observe that most people's understanding of the natural world is informed far more by science fiction than it is by scientific inquiry. How much is the diversity of species imperiled by the popular notion that creatures may be retrieved at some future convenient date by using their bank genetic material? This would amount to a microbiological silent running scenario where good intentions actually accelerate the danger due to false security.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and there are increasing numbers of institutions that are what's called, cryobanking, so banking in liquid nitrogen, the genetic material of species that are, on the brink of extinction or over the brink. There are now some species that do exist on ice that don't exist on in any other way, not too many, but a couple. And this question of what's become known as de-extinction, are we going to just bring those animals, back out of the ice, clone them? That's a really interesting question. I think it does raise really serious questions about whether people are going to say, not to worry in the future, that rhino species that died off, we're just going to bring them back. And while I don't think it's beyond the realm of the possible that we will eventually be able to do that because genetics are moving so, so quickly, you do have to ask yourself, what is the point of bringing back that, say, rhino, if you don't have any place to put them except for a zoo, for example. So if we're destroying the habitat that rhino lived in, if that's why that rhino went extinct, then why bring them back?
Elizabeth Colbert is with us. Her new book is The Sixth Extinction. And it's a pretty specific question from a guy named Ken who says, I'm an avid fly fisherman, and one of our local invasive species is the water hyacinth plaguing the delta. On any given day, waterways can be clogged with this dense vegetation, prohibiting access. Seems like our state government is doing little to eradicate this invader. Who knows what impact it's having on the delta ecosystem? Good point. And officials in Sacramento, are you listening? Killian writes, most predictions about climate change are based on CO2 emissions. I was wondering if Elizabeth Colbert could comment on the reports of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group predicting temperature increase of several degrees within the next decade based on Arctic methane release.
Well, Arctic methane is a very, very big worry. It's sort of one of those worries that I would group under, what keeps you up at night? Do you reach some point where you're going to start releasing massive amounts of methane from the permafrost in the Arctic, and the system will, sort of feed on itself. The idea that we're going to get several degrees in the next decade or so, I don't think anyone would find that plausible. These things do take, a bit longer than that, it seems. But the possibility, methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, I should add, more powerful than carbon dioxide. There's a lot of it in the permafrost, which we're, warming up, and the possibility of runaway methane or nearly runaway methane releases is it's not implausible, and I think it does keep a lot of scientists up at night.
And here's Ryan. Ryan, you're on. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Well, it's not just scientists who stay up at night. My question is just about that. How do people hear this kind of stuff? It's not only frightening, it's sad. And I imagine, having written this book and studied like you have, you've thought about this. Why do people hear this stuff on the radio or read a book or learn in class and then just go on living the regular way that they do, which inevitably is causing all this?
Ryan, you're raising a profound philosophical question.
You are, and I'm glad you raised it. I'm going to say at the outset, I don't have a good answer for it. I think, you know, there are a bunch of reasons. One of which is, you know, people compartmentalize their lives, and they can hear sad things and even absorb them to a certain extent, and go on doing what they're doing. And another,
forgive me, but to wit, we live here in earthquake country. We know inevitably we're going to get a big seismic shake, and yet we go on with our lives.
That's very much, you know, an analogous process has that. And but another thing is, and I think, you know, I think people, and I also, you know, to a certain extent fall into this, and maybe it's why I wrote the book as a sort of a, you know, my own personal attempt to get out of it, is people feel powerless. This is a huge, huge global problem. How am I going to solve it? And I don't have the answer for that, you know, except to try to get people thinking and aware and as our caller suggests, to change the way we're doing things.
Well, another listener tweets, how can, it's a kind of appropriate question, dovetailing on Ryan's question, how can mass extinction be communicated more compellingly and made to matter to a much larger audience? I guess, Ryan, thank you for the question. That's really sort of a part of the whole equation. Karen writes, air travel, how has it changed the health of the planet and those of us on it? And what can we do to reduce or offset those effects? Outside of purchasing a battery-powered vehicle, how do we as individuals need a change in order to lessen the effects of our advancements? We had Tom Zellner on yesterday. He's written a book about the whole history of trains, and it feels it's time maybe to go back to the future and bring trains back because of all the CO2 that's coming out of airplanes.
Yeah, see, airplanes are, I mean, you know, airplanes are just one of the ways we get around and burn fossil fuels. And what's, I think, important about air travel is that it makes us, it enables us, let's just say, to travel much, much longer distances, right? So now, you know, we can go halfway around the world in the course of a day, which we simply couldn't do beforehand. It would take us days and days and days on a ship. So it's really dramatically increase the number of miles that all of us, you know, certainly including me, are traveling on using fossil fuels, and that has, you know, the usual repercussions for the atmosphere and the chemistry of the oceans. So, you know, all of transportation is implicated in that, and we really need a much, much better mass transit system, which would, still produce in the way we power, that would still produce CO2 emissions, but at a much, much lower rate per person per mile traveled. And so I certainly think, and you know what Governor Brown's trying to do, bring high-speed rail. We're way, way behind a lot of the world in our rail travel. It's ridiculous that you can't get around this country on a train and contributing to the problem. But it also contributes to the problem in the ways that we were discussing before, that we move things around the world really quickly now, things that can't survive a long trip, for example, in a boat, let's say, can survive a plane trip. So more and more species, you know, can be transported and are being transported around the world and are surviving and becoming invaders.
This may be a little bit off track, but Al Gore did the review, in fact, cover review in the New York Times Sunday book review section of your book, and he's been on this program a number of times. Another person who comes to mind is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, these are major environmentalists and major spokesmen about climate change, and yet they get criticized a lot for flying around in private planes. And, I mean, this may, again, be taking us off on a different track here, but I think I understand, you know, where that criticism comes from, particularly when you're going to be a major spokesperson.
You know, I think I always say, and I you know, obviously can't speak for anybody else, but I always say I am, as you know, I try in my own life to do thing. You know, I have solar panels on my home that really produce really pretty much all of our electricity at this point. I, you know, drive a hybrid car, but I am just as much a part of the problem as absolutely anyone else, and I never suggest that if people just, you know, lived the way I did, we would solve this problem. And I think every one of us who lives in this country, really, unless you are, you know, forgive me for saying, basically living on the street, we are all part of the problem, and we all, you know, to the same extent, also need to be part of the solution. And I don't you know, in any way preach or hold up myself as any kind of example. I am, you know, I fly places. I'm very much part of the problem. I know people now who will say they don't fly anywhere, for example, and I admire that a lot.
We were talking a lot about natural and unnatural, and Jenny tweets, the difference between natural and anthropogenic change is that we are thinking moral beings. Another listener writes, isn't it the case of the survival of the fittest? We are surviving and other animals are dying. Right now we think we are at the top of the food chain, but what happens when humans finally get hit by a superbug and we become the extinct animal? Nature is older than we can count, and it will always find a way. And we'll find a way to some more callers here. We go to Dick next. Dick, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Good. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
There's just more information coming out that coastal desalinization plants are being pushed, especially by the current administration, to alleviate the drought as a solution, and that they'll also be causing huge environmental problems with the ocean in terms of increasing in acid, declines of the pelagic food chains, corals. And I'm curious if Dr. Colbert thinks we should we even go in this direction with coastal desalinization.
You know, I'm going to have to say that I really just don't know enough about that issue, being an East Coaster, where that's really
we've done a number of programs on it. It's very expensive. Yeah. Is one of the major obstacles. It keeps coming up over and over.
Yeah, I mean, to do major desalination, for example, that makes a big difference in agriculture, which is, I guess, one of the things we're talking about. As you say, it's just right now it seems to be prohibitively expensive. But what its impact on the coastal ecosystems are, I can't speak to.
We'll have another caller, Lonnie. That's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a Territorian born in Hawaii before we were a state, and I go back and visit now annually. One of the things that come up is that I can't find close coral reef beaches I grew up in have washed away, and I noticed that there's a lot that, of course, the building up of the state of Hawaii is criminal. I have a brother who won't go back because it's heartbreaking for those of us who grew up in the country. Can Elizabeth comment on what's happening with the Sierra Club declaring Hawaii as its number one priority years ago? And also the oceans, because I know that when I go swimming and snorkeling, it's harder for me to find living reefs close to shore to examine, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, it's really hard for me to speak to any particular place, but definitely, you know, there are many, many factors impacting reefs, as you say, especially close shore reefs. Reefs turn out to be really pretty sensitive to lots of environmental change. For example, agriculture and siltation, they need light, right? They're right at the surface of the water, but they're below the water, and they need that light for their symbiotic algae. And when you silt up the water, when you change the water temperature, when you change the water chemistry, all of those things, when you heat up the water, all of those things have impacts on coral. And we are sort of simultaneously doing all of them. So it's not really terribly surprising that they're having trouble, and they're having trouble, you know, all around the world. So it's not surprising to me to hear that places that you went as a kid, you know, have very, very reduced coral cover, or perhaps are just dead at this point.
Our guest, Elizabeth Colbert, and again, she'll be speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30. And our next caller is Val. Good morning.
Hi. I just turned on the program. I can't wait to read the book. I've recently learned about the impacts of factory farming on the environment, all of the resources that it uses. I understand it contributes to global warming more than all forms of transportation. So I'm surprised that hasn't been mentioned, and I apologize if she has talked about it and I didn't hear it.
No, I'm glad you brought it up, Val. Let's hear from Elizabeth Colbert on factory farming.
Well, I think, you know, meat production in general, meat takes a lot of...
You've read Jeremy Rifkin's book? I mean, essentially tries to make the case that meat is the real major, meat manufacturing, major environmental problem.
Yeah. I mean, most estimates are that it is a significant, I don't know if it's going to beat out transportation, to be honest. I'm not sure how that calculation is done, but I'm not going to claim to know the ins and outs of that. But it's big, and animals, they're raising, you know, a pound of beef requires a lot of water. It requires a lot of, you know, inputs of fossil fuels. As certainly the way we do it, at least, and it's. I think there is a very compelling case to be made, that we should all certainly be eating a lot less meat, perhaps be eating no meat. I do find that very convincing.
And we thank you, Val, for the call. Debbie writes, we're all the happy frog in the cold water on the stove while the water slowly heats up, and it's too late to jump out. That's my take on the philosophical question. And I'll bring another caller on. Peter, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks, Michael. Great program. Hello, Elizabeth. Thank you for your book. It seems to me, ironically, that humans are driving evolution backwards by recreating Pangea, but also digging up ancient fossil fuels and returning the climate of the Earth back to the Carboniferous when they were formed and it was very hot.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one of the points I make in the book, that we are actually, you know, sort of driving geological history backwards and at a very high rate. You're absolutely right. When we take fossil fuels out of the ground, we are taking a process, the formation of fossil fuels that took, you know, literally hundreds of millions of years. We're running through those fossil fuels, returning the carbon to the air in a matter of centuries. It's probably, you know, really at an unprecedented rate in geological history. And also, as you say, by effectively reassembling the continents. And another point that people would make is we're also sort of driving evolutionary history backwards. We're simplifying a lot of food chains. We're going to lose, you know, a lot of animals at the top of the food chain. We're going to have much simplified food webs going back to, you know, a very, very long time ago in evolutionary history.
Let me thank Peter, and let me thank you, Jeremiah Colbert. I'm sorry, Elizabeth Colbert, for being with us this hour. They call you Dr. Colbert. I figure I can call you Jeremiah.
Yeah, I was very flattered by that.
Well, and you should be flattered by the writing in here and the research that you've done. It's really top drawer. So thank you so much for spending this time with us. And by the way, there are quotes from two of my idols. I said there when you open the book. One is from Ed Wilson. One is from Jorge Borges. Borges says, centuries of centuries and only in the present do things happen. And Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson, says, if there is danger in the human trajectory, it is not so much in the survival of our own species as in the fulfillment of the ultimate irony of organic evolution, that in the instant of achieving self-understanding through the mind of man, life has doomed its most beautiful creations. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.